Support for this public radio podcast comes from Thrivent Financial, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. ThriventFinancial.com/retirement.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Can I get you an aspirin or two? Maybe a cold compress?
People are really terrified at what's happened to their portfolios, raising the question of whether there's something you can do to control your fears and enable you to think a little more calmly.
He says there is. So, everybody on the couch, it's time for a little fiscal therapy. But for some, a tanking retirement portfolio is the least of their problems. It's a struggle just to get food on the table.
It's hard to sit up there and ask, you know, for help when you're so used to being the one that was helping other people.
A middle-class mother of two finds herself at a food bank. Those stories plus your questions and comments coming up on this edition of Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. It's easy these days to chide the nation's banks for reaping what they sowed, giving out loans and mortgages to people who couldn't afford them. No wonder earnings are in the dump. Problem is, it's scaring the secondhand pants off consumers who suddenly don't know where to put their dwindling stash of cash. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at Thrivent.com/retirement.
Ready for the rundown, or should we say the write-down? Wachovia, $8.6 billion second quarter loss. Washington Mutual, $3.3 billion. That's a lot of wah moolah. SunTrust of Atlanta, Fifth Third of Cincinnati, all delivered miserable earnings this week. Of course, bank stocks rallied on the news. Chalk it up to investors who had too much Honey Nut Cheerios and are certain, just certain, that the worst may be over until tomorrow. Meanwhile, what's a bank depositor to do? Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
First off, it depends how much money you've got in the bank. John Mitchell is former chief economist at U.S. Bank in Portland. He says if it's less than $100,000, the FDIC has you covered.
The vast majority of people are protected by deposit insurance. And if you have under the limits, there's basically nothing to worry about.
That's easy for him to say. But we bank customers are getting bombarded by news that makes us decidedly jittery. Then there's the email I got last week from a local community bank. It tried to reassure me that the bank's balance sheet is fine and depositors' money is safe, which didn't make me feel much better. So I thought I'd check in with the bank's president. Dave Williams is with Shore Bank Pacific. I asked him how to tell if a bank's healthy.
So you want to know that your bank is well capitalized, which means it's got more equity available in the event of some hit that they have to take in earnings.
In other words, has your bank got enough in its bank to weather a crisis, like some loans going bad or the assets it owns losing value? Williams says it's also worth checking to see if your bank is already in trouble.
Is the bank operating under a memorandum of understanding with the FDIC or a cease and desist order? Now, you look at, there are something on the order of 7,800 banks in the United States today. 99 of them are on a watch list. So that's a really trivial amount of banks that are on a watch list.
Slightly above 1%, in fact. That number may be small, but Jane DeRista of the Financial Markets Center says depositors shouldn't be complacent. They should look beyond the money they have in savings accounts and CDs. She says if a bank fails, depositors will eventually get their money.
But in many cases, these depositors are also investors, whether they know it or not. If they have pension funds, then their pension funds are probably invested in bank stocks. If they become worried about the banks, of course, that is going to bring down the bank stocks further. So one way or another, the average American, the middle class American, is being deeply affected by this financial crisis.
And all the banking folks I talked to agreed there's likely to be more quarterly losses, more banks in trouble, and possibly even more bank failures as the financial crisis runs its course. In Portland, I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. Marketplace Money is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
Even if you're not worried about your bank, chances are you're worried about your investments. Whether it's your 401k or college savings account, those balances aren't looking very pretty. If you're about to cut and run, wait till after you hear from our next guest. Jason Zweig is a personal finance columnist for The Wall Street Journal, and he recently participated in an experiment where he looked at some scary images and then was coached through some mental tricks to lessen the shock. And Jason, what made you subject yourself to this kind of mental punishment?
Well, what prompted me to do this is if ever there's been a time when the stock market has scared the daylights out of people, I would think it'd be the last few weeks. And people are really terrified at what's happened to their portfolios, raising the question of whether there's something you can do to control your fears and enable you to think a little more calmly. Because selling is one thing, but selling purely because you're terrified is another.
So what is going on in our heads as we're watching our 401k balances take a nosedive?
Well, as your 401k implodes, what's happening is there's a particular structure in the brain called the amygdala, which scientists have shown is one of the fear centers, and it kicks in with incredible speed, and that can lead you to act in a way that might be against your long-term best interest.
It sounds like we're talking here about the basic fight or flight mechanism, aren't we?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. This process in your brain can get you into trouble as a long-term investor, but of course it keeps us alive when we're confronting almost any kind of natural danger, whether it's a snake slithering across the path in front of us or a lion jumping at us, anything like that.
Yeah. So what's the answer then? What did you learn in terms of helping the rest of us take a chill pill instead of dumping all of our stocks?
When something is really frightening you, as a stock market crash will, you have to say to yourself, use your words and come up with a way to describe what's happening in a scenario that's less threatening. So one simple suggestion is, instead of comparing the value of your portfolio now to where it was at its peak, instead ask yourself if the investments that I own were actually given to me as a present. Would the recent decline in their prices make me want to return them? Or, now that they're on sale, maybe I should go and put some of my own money into them. And once you start that process, you'll find yourself feeling calmer and more rational about it.
Except I have to say that it's hard to think of it as a gift when it's my own hard-earned money that's already in there.
Well, then try another strategy test, which is imagine that you had to advise someone you know. Think of the questions you would ask. You'd probably ask things like, is your original rationale for making this investment still valid? Other than the price, what else has changed? There may be negative answers to those questions, but those are the right ways to think about it rather than just the stock market is crashing, I got to get out.
Of course, when we're talking about an official bear market, we're not talking about just a small one-day downtick. I mean, a lot of people are looking at 20% losses.
Yeah, that's correct. And that's why it's important not to try to minimize the fear and the pain you feel. I'm not saying that you shouldn't be afraid, and I'm not saying that losing money doesn't hurt. It does. But there's a big difference between feeling afraid and acting afraid. One thing I recommend, fill in the blanks in a simple sentence, and it goes something like this. Today, the Dow closed blank, and that made me feel blank. And you'll suddenly see that you're really letting yourself be hostage to what other people do. And you'll almost certainly be sorry later.
All right. Well, Jason, I guess we'll see if people follow this particular prescription. And I think from now on, I'm going to be referring to you as Dr. Zweig. Thanks so much.
Well, thanks, Dr. Vigeland.
Jason Zweig's most recent book is Your Money and Your Brain. And an update on a story we aired earlier this year about all those hidden fees in your 401k program. This week, the Labor Department proposed some new rules that would make it way easier to figure out just what those fees are costing you. You have until September 8th to let them know what you think. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And Chris, the bad news just does not end, my friend. I mean,
no.
Bank earnings, bad. Housing market, bad. Economy, bad. What's next?
Oh, I think there are more bank failures, bad. And you know, Tess, I'm in the camp that says, look, the Fed, the Treasury, they've been taking all these actions to shore up the financial system. And I say, bravo. I really do believe that they staved off a financial collapse.
But what are we doing counting on the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury Department to bail us out?
Yeah, that's worrisome. You know, I think what we're seeing is the consequence of actions that have been taken over the past three decades. The shredding of the social safety net. I mean, let me just tick off a few highlights. Fewer people have health insurance. Healthcare plans, they're a lot less generous than they used to be. Pensions, they're full of holes. So here's the straight story. Workers and their families, they're now absorbing most of the cost when money goes bad and the economy spirals down. And that means we're more dependent than ever on the monetary authorities to bail us out.
What does that mean for us, that we are now relying on the federal government, the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Treasury Department to fix all these problems?
I don't like it. You know, we can say don't take on debt and you need to save more. Well, you know what? The way our economy has evolved, you are on your own. You need to be more risk averse. You need to be more conservative. It's not just a function of the downturn in the economy. And this is disturbing, but I'm fairly convinced that the risk of losing your job, the financial consequences of losing your job, are greater today than they were three decades ago.
How did we get to the point, Chris, where we all have seemingly accepted less health insurance that costs more, pensions that are full of holes? I mean, all that stuff that you said, you know, there's no big hue and cry within the American population to fix all of this.
I think we're at a turning point, but you're absolutely right. And the reason why there hasn't been a hue and cry is we've become a wealthier society and we took on a lot of debt. But what's happening now is a lot of that debt's going bad, and we're not getting wage increases. We haven't been getting them for a long time, but now we're not getting them, and we can't borrow. And so my sense is that people are increasingly upset about the way their pension plans are being managed and the risks that we're taking. I mean, is it really good public policy that we're making decisions about, well, how much should I be in equities?
Right.
You know,
right.
How much international stock should I own? And I'm making decisions and you're making decisions that will have implications for your living standard 30 years down the road. Is that what people should be doing? And it's this downturn in the economy that's sort of ripping apart and showing how vulnerable we all are.
All right. Our own Chris Farrell with a little perspective on what's going on with the government bailout of this economy. Thanks so much, Chris, and we'll talk to you later in the show.
Okay, Tess.
More and more families are turning to food banks for help in this down economy.
It's a humbling experience to go from making all this money and everything looks great, and then all of a sudden just looking out and wondering where and when we'll have money to buy food.
We'll talk to a woman who used to be the one doing the helping. It's all coming up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Veglund. One of the common themes running through this recession, or whatever you want to call it, is the steep fall so many people are experiencing from what were just a year or so ago lofty heights. Yes, many of them were living on borrowed money and time, but the living was pretty good. And now, a food bank? I met Elaine, a 41-year-old mother of two from Altadena, California, at the Foothill Unity Center. She was there with her six-month-old. Foothill is part of the Los Angeles Regional Food Bank Network. Last year, the center distributed more than 2 million pounds of food to low-income families. This year, the number of families in need is up 50%, in large part because of situations like Elaine's.
We really just don't know what's going to happen, but we've been in foreclosure 77 days now, so.
Elaine worked as a loan processor. Her husband was a mortgage broker. She says they cleared somewhere north of $100,000 a year and had no trouble supporting themselves and their two small children until the housing market crashed. And now?
We haven't had a real estate transaction since December. So we had to take all of our E-Trade accounts, close them out. You know, we had to juggle from paying electricity and gas. And it's a humbling experience to go from making all this money and everything looks great, and then all of a sudden just looking out and wondering where and when we'll have money to buy food.
They defaulted on their home loan in January and quickly burned through about $20,000 in savings. So now most expenses are going on credit cards. Her husband is pounding the pavement for a new job while she stays home with the newborn. And so here she was at Foothill for a once-a-month supply of basic foodstuffs. The center's warehouse sits adjacent to a small office and waiting area. A gentleman named Ray was stocking Elaine's food cart.
This is our USDA can pack.
All canned foods?
Yeah. And then they get two bags of cans. This is our dry packs.
Dry goods?
Yes.
From there, he retrieved dairy items from an industrial-sized fridge, whole milk, and 2 quarts of buttermilk, plus strawberries, oranges, bread, and 2 plastic grocery bags worth of fresh vegetables.
These freezer bags, they come with shrimp, whipped cream, ground turkey, and breakfast sausage.
With her cart filled, I asked Elaine whether it was going to last her a full month.
Not really, but a lot of the canned goods and stuff like that, but definitely the vegetables. You learn to make soups. It's funny because I had called my mom, who lives in Houston, and so she was like giving me different things that you can do with stuff so that, and freeze this and do that. She goes, this is how it was back in the day. You know, when things got rough, that's what you did. And so I was like, great. So that's what I did. I made vegetable soup, some pasta, put things in the freezer, and that way that extended.
She also has the option of coming back weekly for more fresh produce. But it's been an adjustment.
And it's crazy to go from normally going to Trader Joe's, Whole Foods, and buying the organic to where it doesn't matter. Canned foods, seriously, never used them. Now, if I didn't have canned foods, I don't know what I would do.
Do you ever think that you'd find yourself at a food bank?
No, never. I worked in nonprofit for a few years, and I worked on Skid Row and giving vouchers and helping people. Never.
We're seeing probably an increase of 30 families minimum a week new coming into our offices.
Barbara Case is the site manager for Foothill Unity Center. She says clients are allowed to pick up food if they meet certain income requirements. They start at the national poverty level and serve families that make up to 150% of that. So that means a family of four must have an income below $31,800. And the current economy is forcing more and more people under that cutoff.
Because of the cost of food and the cost of gasoline, and they need the gasoline so they can continue to go to work. So they're having to cut back on food. A lot of them are somewhat embarrassed to have to come and ask for help, but everyone is struggling right now.
Thanks, Barbara.
Part of Elaine's struggle was asking for help at all.
At first, I wasn't sure how it was going to be. I mean, it helped. It really helped because it's hard to sit up there and ask, you know, for help when you're so used to being the one that was helping other people.
And she is still helping. She signed up to volunteer at the food bank on days when she's not using it. You heard that mention of gas prices forcing people to choose between buying food and driving to work. Well, one solution, if you've got a gas guzzler, might be to downsize to a smaller, more fuel-efficient car. But Marketplace's John Dimsdale cautions you need to look carefully at all the costs and benefits.
Mike Graff is the used car manager at Page Toyota outside Detroit. He's seen the look on the faces of customers tired of paying $150 just to fill up.
You know, when somebody pulls in a truck, they're trying to get out of the truck. You know, they're just spending so much money.
Graff says he's happy to help customers out. The problem is the value of used trucks and SUVs is dropping fast. There's little demand for them, and since car dealers are offering huge discounts on brand new ones, used ones are even cheaper. Graff says owners who are still paying off a car loan frequently owe more than they'll get from a trade-in.
You're talking sometimes $8,000 to $9,000 difference between what the payoff is and what the car's worth.
Plus, there's the rising cost of hard-to-find fuel-efficient cars. Toyota dealers say there's a six-month wait for a Prius, and some are tacking on $2,000 or $3,000 to the $24,000 list price. Tempting though it may be to unload that big car for a more fuel-efficient model as soon as possible, it may not be the best financial decision, says Jeff Bartlett, the deputy editor for ConsumerReports.org.
There are a couple somewhat hidden costs to owning a car that people looking to downsize may not see. They include depreciation, which is greatest in the first year, and the other is the interest that would be paid on a loan. So while you may save $1,000 or even more in exchanging for a more fuel-efficient vehicle, that vehicle may depreciate thousands of dollars.
According to Consumer Reports, depreciation makes up half an average new car's costs during the first 5 years. Fuel, even at today's prices, averages only a fifth of a new car's costs. And that means the longer you keep your car, the better. One way to avoid the cost of depreciation is to buy a used car instead. Bartlett says you'd have to drive a new Prius 100,000 miles before it becomes more cost-effective than buying a used Toyota Tercel.
Buying used is always a smart economic choice, as long as you're buying a model that's new enough to have good reliability and the latest safety features and still perform well. There are many used models that have very good fuel efficiency. You may give up a mile or two per gallon versus the latest model, but you'll be saving it in your money in other ways.
A used smaller car may save money, but not if it's too used, says Clarence Ditlow at the Center for Auto Safety.
We wouldn't support going to a 10-year-old small car simply because the ones that have been built over the last 2 or 3 years are much better vehicles.
Ditlow says don't let high gas prices drive you into an unsafe small car.
You need to have electronic stability control, you need to have side curtain airbags, and you need to have strong, well-engineered occupant compartment integrity. Those were not primary design concerns on the small cars that were built in the mid-1990s to 2000.
Consumer Reports has developed a way to compare the cost of fuel efficiency by dividing the new car price by the miles per gallon. Topping the list of price per miles per gallon is the Honda Fit Sport with a manual transmission. The Prius and Honda Civic Hybrid, with their much higher prices, are farther down the list. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at gather.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, online at kauffman.org.
It's time for Getting Personal, when we answer your questions. And with me once again is our personal finance expert, Chris Farrell. And Chris, let's go right to the phones. Jana is with us from New York, New York. Hi, Jana.
Hello.
How can we help you today?
Well, I have to say that I was one of those people that was caught in the Indy Mac scare. And I sort of feel like I just saw the four horsemen of the apocalypse and I should be pulling everything I own out of everything and stuffing it in my mattress.
Oh, no, 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 no,
no, no, no, no, no.
But I had laddered two CDs there, and then I've just been letting them roll, and I've gone over the interest amount that's FDIC insured. So I have an appointment with the FDIC to discuss what I can recover. I won't have lost my initial investment because that was under that amount. But I still don't know what I can expect when I talk to the FDIC.
First of all, I think the likelihood is that she will get more than $100,000 back out of what is now IndyMac Federal Bank, especially if you're not way over $100,000.
No, it's the interest. So probably it's about, you know, $7,000.
I'd be absolutely stunned if she doesn't get the full amount. It's really not an issue that the FDIC is going to back these. It's unusual where you wouldn't get the full amount. You're not that much over. They're taking a very strong stand here.
So it is not Armageddon.
It is not Armageddon. Then there's a bigger question about, okay, with this really safe money, what do you do with it? I mean, do you put it into CDs even though you're over the limit? I think there's several answers to that. Part of it is you put it into under $100,000 into a federally insured bank, and it is completely safe. So I wouldn't worry about it as long as you're under $100,000. If you're in a position that you're in where you're really starting to make some real money, you can put some real savings aside, more than $100,000, I'm going to direct you, just like I direct everybody, which is to go to the U.S. Treasury and to buy into the full faith and credit of the federal government, and is to own U.S. Treasury bills, U.S. Treasury notes, and there is no way that a U.S. Treasury bill, a Treasury note, is going to go bankrupt. And if you go to that, you know, www.treasurydirect.gov, it's very easy to find out how to do it. They work with you, and you don't have to worry about that money. But another safe way is to put some of your money, because you might need some of it, into money market mutual funds that are primarily or almost exclusively composed of Treasury bills and some U.S. agency debt. Extremely low risk. I don't think you really need to worry about it. And frankly, anybody who does that can sleep at night.
Well, thank you so much for your advice. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks for the call.
Bye.
All right, Chris, as you know, and I know, our website is marketplace.org, and folks can click on the Getting Personal link there or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Let's go to an email, and Carol writes in from San Diego, California. She's got approximately $16,000 in credit card debt. That's across three different credit cards. But recently, she received a solicitation in the mail for a Bank of America clean sweep loan of up to $50,000. It's got a fixed 7.9% APR. She's wondering, what is this clean sweep loan, and should she take it?
The way I look at the clean sweep loan or similar loans being offered by other banks, it's really a consolidation loan.
Right.
So you're taking these three credit cards, right?
Which probably have higher interest rates.
Which have higher interest rates, and then you pay off those credit cards with the loan money, and then you pay off that loan. And it can work, just like all consolidation loans can work, with a couple of basics. The consolidation loan, the clean sweep loan, does not solve your problem. And sometimes people get into trouble with these kinds of loans because they pay off their credit cards. And let's just make up some numbers, Tess. So she has $16,000 credit card debt, right? She pays off the credit card debt, and then she's paying off her clean sweep loan or whatever it's going to be called, and she starts using the credit cards again.
Now she's got all kinds of credit available to her.
Exactly. And so people get into trouble. So again, you go back to the real fundamentals. First thing is budgeting. How do you get into $16,000 in credit card debt? There could be lots of good reasons. There could also be bad reasons. And then you look at something like this sweep loan and you ask yourself, okay, is this a tool that will make it easier for me to pay it off? There's a fee associated with this type of loan. Typically, it's around 3%. And there's a prepayment period. So let's say you pay it off in 3 or 4 years. All right. All of a sudden, the cost now has ballooned on you because you're taking a longer period of time to pay it off. Is there a prepayment penalty? When does that prepayment penalty expire? So you really have to read the fine print and then ask yourself, is this a tool that will get me out of debt faster than what I'm already doing?
Either way, you need to start paying it off.
It's not that hard to write three bills a month, frankly. And if you're reducing it and you're not paying any extra fees, I would just focus on getting down that credit card debt.
All right. Our phone number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And now we're answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link on our website and stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I want to believe that the new X-Files movie opening this weekend will be as creepily awesome as the TV series. It's been quite the summer for blockbusters, what with Batman setting all kinds of box office records, Will Ferrell back on the silver screen, oh, and let's not overlook the space chimps. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we meet someone who's behind a lot of successful movies.
My name is Derek Reed. I'm a projectionist here at the Cinémathèque Québécois, which is a film archive in Montreal, Canada. What you have here is a classic projection booth. You have two 35mm projectors, and as you can see here, it's a pretty classic-looking machine. It has big gears with a lens and a gate, which opens and closes where the image of the film is seen through. I actually got into this as a doorman. It was my job while I was a student, and I learned to project film as an apprentice. At the time I learned to project, there was a license, and you had to get an apprentice book, and you had to study under somebody for 500 hours. They've since eliminated all of that, and their argument was that because film's no longer flammable, anyone can do it. Basically, what you need to be a good projectionist is you need to be able to keep track of what's going on, because you have to be there when you need to be there. And if you're not there, then of course your error appears on the screen for everybody to see. Someone once told me that I'm the only sane projectionist they ever met, because long hours in the booth with lots of noise alone drives people crazy. The salary in this job, it's around $20 an hour, which isn't that much money. I watch my movies often in bits and pieces, because I'll be busy at the beginning of the film and then I'll go and watch the end of the film. So I can actually have a completely different impression of a film and then finally sit down and watch it and realize that it wasn't like it is at all. I often get asked how many movies I've seen. I had calculated that I had showed 10,000 movies in my first 10 years, but I've never gotten sick of movies. I still watch movies. I rent movies. I watch them at home. I still go to the movies. I just don't go to the movie theater that I work in, and I enjoy movies very much.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Judith Ritter. Coming up, it's time to end our series about the end. Do living trusts move with you from state to state?
Usually, because a living trust is not managed by the courts whatsoever, you shouldn't have any problem in having that living trust be adequate in a new place.
We'll answer your questions about estate planning. Or is that estate? Stay with us for more Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Today we get to our final conversation about your final will and testament. Our series on estate planning generated hundreds of questions from you. So to help answer them, we are joined once again by John Ventura, the author of Kiplinger's Estate Planning. And John, let's start with a listener in Cincinnati. Now, with bank accounts, you have something called a due on death clause. They want to know if there's something similar for real estate.
Normally, a person would use a living trust to transfer property after death if they wanted to avoid probate. However, Ohio and many other states have a thing called a transfer on death deed. And what that deed does allows you to designate a beneficiary, and then when you die, the property is transferred to that person without having to go through probate, which is very good. They'll have access to it right away, and there's no cost and things like that. And it's fairly easy to revoke that if you need to do that.
All right, let's go to another question. A listener in Greensboro, North Carolina wanted to know, can I designate a revocable trust as my IRA beneficiary to provide lifetime income to my surviving spouse and at her death, then distribute what is remaining to qualified charities?
You can designate a trust to be the beneficiary of an IRA. And what happens is if you die, the IRA is moved to the trust. and then the trust will have management power over that. However, you know, you have to really look at whether that's the right thing to do. If you have a spouse that's going to survive you, that spouse usually has some elections, and it might be better to consider having the spouse as the IRA beneficiary and then the trust as a secondary beneficiary of that IRA.
We got an email from someone in Brooklyn, New York, who wanted us to address a document called Five Wishes. It's essentially a packet where you can do your living will and other really basic information for survivors. Is this accepted in most states?
You know, it's accepted in many states. And what this does really is take the place of a living will. It gives you an opportunity to say how you want to be treated when you get sick or if you're dying and you're not able to speak for yourself. You have to be careful to make sure it's approved in your state, but I do recommend things like this. I think it's excellent.
And a listener from Cincinnati wrote in and said, we have our home inside of a living trust in the state of Ohio, and they wondered if this person needs to go into a nursing home and needs to be put on Medicaid, will his wife be able to keep the family home that is inside the trust?
And the answer to that is if you go into a nursing home and you need Medicaid, your house is not normally counted as an asset if you intend or expect to return back home. Now, if you go to a nursing home and you do not expect to get back home, the house is not counted for Medicaid if any of the following people live in it: your spouse, if you have a child under 21, an adult that's blind or disabled that's living there. You know, in any of these kind of situations, then the house would not be counted. Now, if you're not going to go back to your home and you do not have these kind of people living in your house, then you may have to sell it.
All right, John, we got a comment from a listener in Cary, North Carolina, who told us, do your research before deciding on an executor of your estate, because this listener's family found out firsthand that states such as Florida restrict out-of-state executors. Is this familiar to you?
Yeah, it is. It comes up, especially now when we have people moving to different parts of the country. Each state does have requirements as to non-resident executors. It's a good reason that if you're going to spend a great deal of time in another state or you've just moved there, that you may want to reconsider and have someone local be the executor of your estate.
A listener in Winchester, Tennessee wanted to know about pets. They don't have a spouse or children, do have dogs and cats, and want to make sure that those pets are properly cared for in case they should die. This would be the Leona Helmsley question, would it not?
Yeah, it really is. You know, first thing people should know that they really can't make a pet a beneficiary in the will. So if they want a pet taken care of, what they have to do is find someone that are going to be chosen to be the caretakers of your pet. Then you create a trust in your will that names the caretaker, not your pet, as the beneficiary of that trust, that allows for money to go to that caretaker to take care of your pet.
Okay. And John, I have to ask you one final question on my own behalf. We received some very indignant email about how I was pronouncing estate planning or estate planning. Is there a right or wrong, or are we talking tomato, tomato here?
I think it's tomato, tomato, but you know, I've always pronounced it estate planning.
Okay. Well, I guess I've always grown up with estate planning, so perhaps that's an Oregon thing. I don't know. But either way, we thank you so much for all of the information and for answering all these questions today. And once again, John Ventura is the author of Kiplinger's Estate Planning or Estate Planning. Thanks so much for your help.
Thank you for having me on your show, Tess.
And if we didn't answer your question today, head to our website, marketplace.org, for an extended version of our Q&A with John.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
All right, we're back with Getting Personal. And Chris, we've got Steve on the line from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hi, Steve.
How are you?
We're doing all right. How can we help you today?
Well, I have some equity in my home that I would like to pull out to pay off some credit card debt. I don't want to refinance because I'm locked in at a 30-year fixed at 5.625, which
I don't want to change that.
No.
Ooh, that's a good rate.
But I'm wondering if I should go with the line of credit, home equity line of credit, or the home equity loan. I've got a lot of credit card debt because some was unforeseen medical expenses that were not covered.
How much credit card debt are we talking about?
Right around $50,000.
And how much home equity do you have?
About $123,000.
Okay. So, Chris, we're talking a little under 50% of his current equity. First of all, is this a good idea? And then let's talk about the difference between a home equity line of credit and a home equity loan.
Sure. I'm going to give sort of a mixed answer here. One way that a lot of people have gotten into trouble is putting on too much of their debt on their home, their major asset, and getting themselves into financial trouble. Whereas your current situation, you got this huge chunk of credit card debt, but you also got a pretty solid asset with a home with a decent rate. And the credit card debt is unsecured. I mean, the technical term, we call it unsecured. It's just basically your income and your willingness to take that income to pay off that credit card debt. So when you put your home at risk to that, to me, I have to worry about what's the risk-reward ratio here. So what I would do is go conservative is, you know, perhaps you'll take out a little bit of money off a home equity loan or a line of credit to, you know, really start breaking the back of that credit card debt, but maybe not to pay it off so that you're not increasing your overall risk that much. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
All right. So let's go with the difference between a loan and a line of credit.
A home equity loan is designed for you have a big project. So, you know, let's say, Steve, you wanted to remodel your bathrooms. And so you're going to borrow X amount of money, and then you get a fixed rate, and you're going to pay it off a set period of time. A line of credit is more designed for, I'm going to do a little project here, I'm going to do a little project there, so maybe I'll take out $5,000 here, I'll take out $10,000 a year and a half from now. And so a home equity line of credit is more designed for small projects around the house and also as an emergency source of money. If you lose your job, you can, you know, maybe borrow a little bit, take advantage of the home equity line of credit to tide yourself over while you're finding your next job. So one, the way to think about it is the home equity line of credit allows you to tap into it whenever you need it. The home equity loan is really designed more for taking out a chunk of money for a particular reason, a particular project.
Okay, great.
All right, thanks so much for the call.
Have a great day, and thanks for the advice.
Thanks so much.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, our website is marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, we got an email from Barbara in Fridley, Minnesota, and her mother died in 2003, and Barbara was in charge of the will there. Apparently, the estate was pretty simple, and she made all of the disbursements and closed the estate by the end of 2004, so it took about a year. She's wondering what kinds of records she needs to keep for this estate. I assume this would really all be for the purposes of Uncle Sam and the IRS.
And also any of the beneficiaries who signed off on what she did, and then it's filed with the court. So I would keep the exact same thing that I recommend for anybody to keep when it comes to taxes, which is you keep the tax forms. And then you keep the supporting documentation, especially when it involves life insurance and other assets, you know, homes, that type of thing, so that if anybody ever wants to challenge it, including the IRS, you have the forms and you have the supporting documentation. But there's a lot of paper that we all accumulate over a period of time, like canceled checks, that we don't need to keep unless that's part of the supporting documentation.
Okay. What about vital records? She's got birth certificates, marriage certificates, death certificates. Does she need to keep any of those around?
Well, I have sort of two answers to that. And one is, yes, I would keep them. And secondly, it's part of a family history. And frankly, it doesn't take up that much room. So, yes, I would keep it personally.
Okay. Unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. But Chris is answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. Just go to our website. It is marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there. And as always, you can call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks, as always, for the great advice.
Yes, you're welcome.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. So we've dealt with your financial questions. Now it's time for your comments, compliments, and complaints about the show. Last weekend, Chris predicted during our Straight Story segment that Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae will eventually be nationalized. He criticized the current implicit government guarantee to Fannie and Freddie because that makes it hard for private companies to compete. And he said, our system doesn't work that way. Au contraire, mon frère, says Michael Camp Schaefer of Oklahoma City.
The truth is, our system does work that way. The Federal Reserve itself is a collection of private financial entities that fund government debt when Congress has the authority to issue its own currency without the need for such an entity.
You may have caught our recent story about some of the hidden costs of credit card perks, like getting cash back or frequent flyer miles. Jean Hewitt wrote in from Albany, New York, to tell us that a few years ago she was a single parent with two kids in college. She used the lower interest rate come-ons from various credit cards to pay a lot of tuition, textbook, and dorm fees, and in the process rack up some of those perks. She always managed to refinance just before the interest rates jumped. So it works for some people. We talk a lot on this program about something called target date retirement funds. A few weeks ago, author Gene Chatsky called them lifesavers for folks who are math-challenged. They're kind of the finance version of set it and forget it. But George Hangs of Tulsa argues it's too early to get excited about these funds.
It is a big leap to call this class of fund a lifesaver because no one has retired from investments in this kind of fund. They were only invented 5 years ago. Perhaps as time goes by, we will be able to say these funds truly work for retirement savers. At this point, I think there are proven alternatives we should be recommending.
Actually, target date funds have been around since the 90s, but they've definitely come into vogue over the last 5 years or so. And finally, a word from our favorite listener of the week, Dave Callagher, hears us in Iowa City.
I typically don't seek out radio programs focused on personal finance, but Marketplace Money has really got my attention. I think you're doing something right if you attract listeners like me, so keep it up and I'll keep listening.
You got it, BFF. If you have the urge to call us out or give us mad props, go to marketplace.org and click on contact. Well, we just went through your notes, so now it's time for you to take some. Last week, the Securities and Exchange Commission put limits on something called naked short selling. Trust me, it has nothing to do with the altogether. At the blackboard for today's Marketplace Summer School session is our very own Amy Scott.
Short selling is basically a way to make money when a stock price falls. Think about a stock as a box of Girl Scout cookies, maybe Thin Mints. So let's say I'm pretty sure the price of Thin Mints is going to go down. So I borrow a few boxes from my neighbor and sell them at today's price. My hope is that when it's time to pay my neighbor back in a few weeks, the price will have dropped and I can buy the Thin Mints at the cheaper price and pocket the difference. There's nothing illegal about short selling. And in fact, many people say it's good for the market. If a stock is overvalued, short sellers can actually drive the price down, and that can lead to more accurate stock prices for the rest of us. But recently, short sellers have been blamed for driving down the stock prices of some pretty big financial companies. And the Securities and Exchange Commission is investigating whether there was some actual manipulation going on. To try to prevent market manipulation, they've cracked down on a form of short selling known as naked short selling. Let's go back to our Girl Scout cookie analogy. So let's say I never actually borrowed the Thin Mints from my neighbor, but I sold them anyway. That's known as naked short selling. I may have located some Thin Mints from a friend a few blocks away, but never actually sealed the deal. Then when it was time to deliver the boxes, I couldn't meet my end of the bargain. The reason they call it naked is because I'm left uncovered when the deal is actually supposed to be sealed. For the average investor, short selling can be a good thing because it sort of keeps stock prices honest. But naked short selling allows stock manipulators to drive the price down artificially, which is why the SEC is cracking down on it.
Amy Scott is our New York Bureau Chief. Somebody get her a cookie, please. And next week, tune in for tax credit versus tax deduction. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, ever wonder why you buy what you buy?
Any product or brand that sort of takes off in the marketplace, it's never a one-way process. It's not just someone, you know, kind of invents the meaning of a brand and shoves it down our throat and we all accept it.
So he's never heard of Pokemon. Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali with Stephen Hoffman, Janae Darden, Jeff Peters, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tessa Vinklund. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit Fortune 500 financial services organization offering insight, products, and planning tools to help members thrive in retirement. You can learn more at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.